You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. An asylum seeker is somebody looking for a place of refuge. In our current day, we think of political refugees who apply for entrance into a new country. They do this, of course, on the basis of danger. They're facing danger in their places of origin. They're fleeing for safety. And this is often the only recourse for somebody who is persecuted, threatened. Now, I want you to think about this word asylum and put an adjective in front of it now. And the word is insane. Insane asylum. Decades ago, it was very common usage to talk of insane asylums. And the irony of such institutions is that people did not, of their own accord, of their own volition, seek refuge, seek safety in such places. To apply for admission, to be granted asylum, that is very different from finding oneself committed into an asylum. Now, the word itself originally had a positive meaning. The A part, in asylum, it means without. And the asylum part of the word goes back to a legal term in ancient times. That's a right to seize something, to seize control of it. Asylum means inviolable. You may not be taken captive or seized or claimed by another person. You are safe from the control of others. What I'm saying is that this word has had a big flip-flop when it comes to insane asylums. Our guest has a story to tell about a woman in Illinois in the 19th century who fought like a lion for her freedom from an asylum where she had been committed against her will, of course. Kate Moore is with us to talk about this. She's been with us before to talk about her bestseller, The Radium Girls. She has written across a number of genres. Her most recent book is the episode in history I'm talking about, a woman named Elizabeth Packard. We're going to learn about her, her situation, the outcome, her fight, her struggle. The book is titled The Woman They Could Not Silence, One Woman, Her Incredible Fight for Freedom, and the Men Who Tried to Make Her Disappear. Kate Moore, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to talk to you again.
How did you even stumble across this story? I mean, it can happen to anybody. You just one day you drop your jaw and but where were you when you found this?
Well, this was actually a bit of a sort of topsy-turvy story because my sort of idea for writing this book actually came about because I discovered the themes I wanted to write about first. So I first had the idea for this book in the fall of 2017, and it was inspired by the Me Too movement. And what really struck me about that empowering time was that finally women were being listened to and believed. And it got me thinking, you know, why hasn't that happened before and how have women been silenced in the past? And I realised for centuries, whenever women have used our voices, we've been called crazy. Our mental health has been wielded as a weapon against us, used to undermine and control us. So what I wanted to do was to write about those issues, which to me still resonate today. You know, you only have to look at the news the other week, the case of Britney Spears, to see how prevalent it is, you know, right up until the modern day. But I didn't want to write a polemic. I'm a storyteller at heart. You know, I write history books that hopefully take readers on a sort of twisty-turny narrative journey, page-turning chapters and so on. So what I wanted to do was try to find one woman in history to whom this had happened, you know, a sane woman who was called insane simply for being assertive, for using her voice, and who fought for, you know, her freedom and for the right to be herself. And so I went looking for Elizabeth Packard, and I didn't know at that stage what era of history I was going to find this woman in. I didn't know her name. But on the 15th of January 2018, I first read Elizabeth's name in a University of Wisconsin essay that I had randomly found online. And the moment I started looking into Elizabeth Packard's life, I realised she was the one, the woman I wanted to write about next. Because she herself is extraordinary. She's fearless. She's resilient. She herself is an absolutely brilliant writer. But above all else, her story is phenomenal. It's packed full of drama. There's landmark legal cases. There's, you know, men breaking down her bedroom windows with an axe. There's twist of gothic horror, you know, taking you inside the insane asylums of the 19th century. And so for me, the moment I did discover Elizabeth's name in that essay, I knew she was the one I was going to write about next, and I knew I had to bring her story to the world.
Well, we're going to learn more about her, but let's shift our focus just a moment here. I want to hear about the primary villain, her husband, and how mm-hmm. she even ended up connected with him. Marriages, of course, in those days often arranged, but who was he?
So her husband is a man called Theophilus Packard, and he was 15 years Elizabeth's senior and a very different type of person by all accounts. And I actually have had the, I don't know if privilege is the right word, but the privilege of reading his diary and his memoirs that he himself obviously wrote. And he is quite a man, Theophilus Packard. It's a summer I will never get back, the summer that I read his diary. He is a gloomy man. He is a man that predicts his own death, you know, every, you know, second sentence of the diary. You know, a man who the first day of spring arrives and he's like, oh my God, you know, soon the period of death will arrive. That's how he records, you know, the first entry of spring in his diary. So Elizabeth Packard, who was the complete opposite. She was vibrant, she was sociable, she was curious, she had a brilliant mind. She's married to this man, 15 years her senior, a man who was once a colleague of her father. She is married to this man who's gloomy, who is timorous, who by his own account is dull. And so the stage is set for, you know, conflict, essentially. Conflict that didn't arise until they had been married 21 years, because Elizabeth begins the book and begins her marriage as, you know, quite a typical 19th century, you know, woman, a woman who did, you know, obey her father, her husband, a woman who, in her own words, was a silent listener in the world. And the conflict begins when Elizabeth decides that she's not going to be a silent listener anymore. She's going to be an active participant in her own life and in the world that she lives in.
Now, she is schooled, she is trained and is a teacher in her earliest years before she's married, right?
That is correct. Yeah. And as I say, I mean, I keep banging the drum about how exceptional she is, but she truly was a really brilliant woman. You know, even her enemies describe her as having a fine mind and a brilliant imagination. And so, yes, you know, quite unusually for the time, she received a first class education. And she then went on and became a teacher. And at the age of 19, she was the principal of Randolph College in Massachusetts. A college that only employed, as it described it itself, only employed the best classical educators. So Elizabeth had been cherry-picked, you know, from among the best of the best to teach at this college.
But it doesn't go well for her at Randolph College, or at least some incident happens where she's committed early on to some kind of institution, right?
That is correct, yes. She is committed to an insane asylum in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I do want to make the point that she herself always said it was a needless and, you know, unkind thing to have done. And I think she is right, because having seen, you know, the medical notes from her case from the time, we can see that actually the kind of thing that her doctors were concerned about was that she had supposedly gone mad because of mental labour. And the idea in the 19th century actually was that doctors believed that women who studied or read or pursued a career outside of the home, they believed that they were liable to go mad, because doctors believed, and this is a quote from one of the doctor's own writings, they said, when minds of limited capacity to comprehend subjects try to do so, it would lead to mental breakdown. So yes, according to the science of the day, Elizabeth, simply by being a teacher, was liable to go mad. And according to her doctors, she did. She herself said it was a physical ailment, something like, she called it brain fever, which in today's parlance would be something more like meningitis or encephalitis. And she said it was a physical ailment that, you know, caused her to be sick But according to the doctors, they thought she had gone mad and it was a mental illness.
How long was her time there in the asylum?
Well, it was less than 6 weeks, which I think showcases that, you know, it wasn't a sort of long-term breakdown or anything like that by any stretch of the imagination. And it's quite interesting reading the notes because Elizabeth, as I say, is very clever. And I think she cottons on to what she has to do to get released, which is, you know, to become calm, to obey the rules of the asylum, you know, to present herself well, to be pleasant, and so on and so forth. And she gets out in less than 6 weeks.
Yeah. Now, in the course of your study of this whole cultural phenomenon of putting women away by virtue of the fact that they somehow are insane, you've come across quite a list of reasons for, you know, being interned.
An astonishing list. And I would make the point that this list comes from the asylum's own records. So insane asylums in the 19th century used to publish biennial reports, and they would include a list of the causes of insanity in their patients. And they included things like novel reading.
Well, that'll get you every time, won't it?
Exactly. Well, probably, you know, anyone who likes reading, who's listening to this interview, you know, you would be liable to be locked up. That they actually thought that, you know, people reading was enough to send them mad.
So ostensibly, a person might not be liked or might be a problem person in the eyes of somebody, and all they have to do is catch a reading a novel, and that's proof enough?
Pretty much, because it was, I think it's all about sort of the societal expectations. This was a key sort of problem in the 19th century for any woman who was assertive or, you know, had ambitions, because it was about, there was something called moral insanity. This was the diagnosis that affected many of these women, including Elizabeth Packard, who I've written about in the book. And with moral insanity, the sort of definition of it was eccentricity of conduct. But of course, eccentricity of conduct is in the eye of the beholder. And so, you know, the theory ran that a woman was supposed to be satisfied by being a wife and a mother, and any woman who sort of rocked the boat, who was not the sort of placid, docile creature that society expected her to be, well, a doctor or a family member, a husband, a father who was displeased with their wife or their daughter, you know, they could look at their behaviour and say, well, it's eccentric, therefore it's mad, therefore she needs to be sent away to the asylum. And many women could then stay there for decades, if not life. It was a truly horrifying fate for any woman who sort of essentially express personality, because the doctors would see pathology in that female personality.
I'm just kind of curious now for a second, if you see this kind of institution on both sides of the Atlantic, are we talking about insane asylums just in the United States or in Great Britain? I don't know, on the continent?
Well, my research was focused on America because Elizabeth is American and all her experiences take place there. But I did do some research also into Great British asylums and, you know, psychiatry of the era. And it's exactly the same. So, yes, it was happening both sides of the Atlantic.
And in this list of things that may cause insanity, I'm looking right now at something that comes from a report, one of those annual or biennial reports you were talking about. It's stunning. A death of a friend. I mean, you could be experiencing terrible grief upon bereavement, and that's deemed to be insanity.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this was the thing. It was such a sweeping sort of generalized diagnosis, you know, and actually some doctors were critical of it, even in Elizabeth's time. And ultimately, people said it was a misfortune for science that this diagnosis was pursued at all. But yes, the death of a friend could get you, a woman suffering from, you know, postpartum depression could be carted away from her new baby and any other children that she had and locked up. And as I say, for many women, it was locked up and the key was thrown away. You know, a lot of people at that time, you know, they didn't understand insanity and mental health. And for some women, it was the end of the road. You know, that if they had displeased or shamed their families in some way. And this is not just about, you know, a woman who is ambitious. It might be a woman, you know, who brings shame on her family through illegitimate children, through being gay, you know, whatever it is. Her family had the right, the legal right, to send her away, and they often did.
We are going to get more detail about the Elizabeth Packard story and her tearless marriage to the Presbyterian preacher Theophilus Packard. I mentioned that he was a preacher because one of the excuses for locking women away was religious excitement. We're going to get to that part of her story after a short break here on Constant Wonder as we visit with Kate Moore about her book, The Woman They Could Not Silence. Stay with us. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. The Woman They Could Not Silence is the book we're talking about. The subtitle, One Woman, Her Incredible Fight for Freedom and the Men Who Tried to Make Her Disappear. Kate Moore is with us. She's the author. Kate, Elizabeth Packard's story would not have happened had she not been married to a cold-hearted preacher, Theophilus Packard. And one of the reasons often given back in the 1800s for an ostensible cause of insanity was religious excitement. She expressed her religious views. She disagreed with her husband. He threw her into jail, basically, because of theology.
That's correct. I mean, Elizabeth's sort of downfall and her salvation, it's true to say, was essentially that she had a mind of her own. So, yes, she decided to break away from her husband's spiritual teachings. Initially, she goes and worships with the Methodists instead. But simply the fact that she was questioning him and, you know, pursuing her own research into theology and, you know, essentially conducting her own personal relationship with God. When she prayed to him, you know, God was someone with whom Elizabeth felt she had a personal relationship. She didn't need to channel that through her husband. But her husband was outraged by this. And that is part of the reason why he sends her away. You know, and it's true to say as well, obviously, because he was a preacher, Elizabeth leaving his church was a very public rejection of him. And I think that sort of bruised ego also fed into this desire to send his wife away to an insane asylum.
So he has a congregation and they're observing the collapse of this marriage and they're witnessing. I mean, he sees this as a public humiliation.
He does, completely. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So then it sounds like there were maybe factions within the congregation or at least within the community. There were varying voices and people siding with her, people siding against her.
Yes, factions within the community is correct, because actually his parishioners side with the preacher initially, at least. They actually sign a petition saying that they believe Elizabeth is insane and should be, you know, committed to an asylum as speedily as it can be conveniently done. But when you actually hear what the parishioners have to say about why they think Elizabeth mad, you know, the evidence, the so-called evidence that they cite is things like, for example, she shouted at her husband because he had not cleaned the yard. You know, someone else said that her dislike for her husband was evidence of madness. You know, a third person said that because she contributed to the Bible classes that the church ran, he cited her incessant talking as evidence of madness. But as we can see, all these reasons are just further evidence of a woman who was simply pushing boundaries. You know, a woman who, yes, she was married to her husband, but you know, her husband wasn't the dearest creature of her heart. You know, there was tension in the marriage. But the fact Elizabeth articulated it, the fact she would have the audacity to shout at her husband, this was seen by the parishioners as madness. The flip side of the coin are the other people in the community who say they've never seen a sign of Elizabeth being mad, that they think her treatment at the hands of her husband is cruel, that they're shocked by what is, you know, is going on. And yeah, the two sides are pitted against each other, with Elizabeth, you know, caught in the throes of this legal dilemma where her husband has the authority to send her away, no matter what, you know, whether the community is for or against it. Her husband has that power over her.
And I do want to talk a little bit more about that legal situation in those days where the husbands had that prerogative to. But there were children in this marriage as well.
That's right. Yes. Elizabeth is a mother of six. And actually, at the point she is sent to the asylum, the youngest is only 18 months old. You know, she's only recently weaned him from the breast. Her eldest is 18 years old. And so, yes, there are children involved. And that is, you know, another reason that Theophilus cites for sending Elizabeth away. He thinks her influence over the children, you know, is scandalous because she's teaching them that they're not necessarily damned, you know, from birth. And so he is, you know, has even more motivation to try and shut her up and to send her away.
Now, he's a hellfire and damnation type preacher. I mean, this is a stock character, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. Although, as I say, having read Theophilus's diary, he really is a sort of law unto himself. You know, he's just he is quite the character.
And she expressed in her writings that she did not want her children to be told over and over and over again that they were damned souls unless they, I don't know, complied with his expectations.
Well, complied with his expectations and, you know, followed his teachings. As you say, he was a hellfire and damnation type preacher. Well, he would lecture his children, you know, from the moment they came into the world, basically. You know, there are accounts from both the Packards of him making the children cry. You know, you've sort of got a five-year-old, you know, howling with despair that he's going to be burned alive and sent to hell. And Elizabeth was very concerned about this impact on her children. She wanted to teach some personal responsibility as well. You know, that they did have the power to change their lives and that they did have, you know, the power to decide whether they were going to be good or bad. And, you know, that was kind of on them as well. So there was a real split in the marriage, you know, along several fault lines, basically.
Talk about how she's, you know, how she lands there in the asylum. This is quite the drama.
Well, it really is the drama. So Elizabeth is concerned by her husband's threat because he says to her, you know, he literally uses it as leverage. You know, if you don't conform, if you don't do what I say, I will send you to the asylum. So she has forewarning and she's worried about it. She actually seeks legal advice and she is told, don't worry about it. You know, you will get a jury before a six-man, you know, a trial before a six-man jury before you'll be sent to an asylum. That is the law of Illinois. And so Elizabeth relaxes a little bit. But then on the 18th of June, 1860, she wakes, you know, first thing in the morning and she sees a group of men coming to her door. She's frightened, you know, this threat of her husband's is in the back of her mind and she doesn't know what's happening. She locks the door to her bedroom. The handle rattles. They're trying to get in. The next thing she hears as she's quickly throwing on clothes, trying to get dressed in the morning, is she sees and hears the gleam of an axe as it hacks its way into her bedroom. And these men seize her. They put her on the train to Jacksonville, Illinois. And that summer's night, she is committed to the insane asylum. And she protests. She says, you know, what about my trial? You know, she's actually been mentally preparing for a trial. But her husband reveals that actually the law does not apply to married women. Married women can essentially be treated exactly as their husbands want to treat them. The law was that wives could be sent away to asylums by request of the husbands, and specifically without the evidence of insanity required in other cases. That was the law in Illinois at that time, and it was also the law in other states as well. And so husbands literally had the power, if they had an unsatisfactory wife, to dispatch her to an asylum and the doctors would accept her. And in Elizabeth's case, you mentioned religious excitement earlier, but actually she wasn't admitted as a case of religious excitement. She was admitted for excessive application of body and mind. Or as she put it, she'd been placed there by her husband for thinking.
take 1860, that year, and compare it to the beginning of the Civil War. And when we talk about human rights, you know, so many of the narratives that we hear from this time period do focus on issues of race. Sometimes I wonder if the issue here of this brutal sexism doesn't somehow fall in the shadow of the other stories. You know, I'm not trying to compare them, but I mean, these are concurrent.
Yes, they are concurrent. And, you know, Elizabeth did see parallels as well, you know, in the sort of fight for freedom and emancipation. Because, you know, it's not just, the laws are not just set up so husbands can send their wives to asylums. Husbands had complete power over their wives. You know, they had power over their, you know, their wives' earnings. You know, a woman couldn't even keep her own earnings if her husband wanted to seize them. She had no custody of her children, no right to property. So it really was, a husband had complete power. It was a law known as coverture, which was actually inherited from England. So it seems we Brits have a lot to answer for. But you're right, you know, these sort of themes of fighting for freedom were running concurrently. And it is a parallel that I sort of sketch in the book as well. You know, as that fight for the sort of national, on the national stage is happening, Elizabeth is fighting a very private battle, really, you know, in the shadow of this hulking insane asylum, trying to get out and trying to win back her own life, really, the power to live her life as she herself wants to do it, and to, you know, find what essentially is this unsilenceable voice. You know, that the book is actually the journey not only of Elizabeth being locked up and fighting for her freedom, it's also the story of a woman, you know, discovering through the fire of adversity, you know, how to use her voice, you know, what it is she wants to say. And in Elizabeth's case, she decides that actually the private battle that she's fighting isn't enough. She writes, "I don't want another sister in America to suffer as I have." And so she ultimately decides to use her newly found voice to fight for the freedoms of all women in America. And that's partly why I wanted to write about her as well, because she's left this extraordinary legacy behind.
She's then in this institution for 3 years, I believe. And then during that time period, what does she experience? What is her communication to the outside world? How does she describe it all?
Well, it's a horrendous situation. Basically, the asylum is an incredibly cruel place. It's an abusive place. Elizabeth witnesses, you know, some of the most horrifying abuse that you can imagine. And she decides that she is not going to be a silent listener, a silent witness to it. She's going to record it, and she decides to keep a secret journal. She's not allowed to write, you know, she's not even allowed that voice on paper, but she steals scraps of fabric and, you know, rips out the margins of newspapers, and she keeps this secret journal for 3 years of everything that's going on. And the asylum is really just as you would imagine, you know, the horror of a 19th century asylum to be. You know, the attendants are straight out of that gothic horror literature that I mentioned, you know, earlier in the interview, but this is all real. And I think that's one of the most horrifying things about The Woman They Could Not Silence, is that everything in it is real. But as I say, the inspiring thing about it is that despite the horrors that Elizabeth Packard encounters, she decides she is going to combat them. And so it is actually an inspirational story of a woman finding her voice and using it to change the world.
So is this the institution where at night they're deprived of their clothing so they can't escape through a window? Or is it, maybe I'm getting the wrong story.
No. That is correct. So yes, the women were not allowed to have their own clothes in their own rooms to prevent these sort of midnight flits. And everything was monitored. You know, the women had no freedom to do as they wished to do. You know, everything was prescribed. They couldn't stay in their bedrooms, lie on their beds. Their menstrual cycles are monitored. Some women have their hair shorn off when they arrive at the asylum. There is complete control over them. And actually, the doctor in charge of the institution, Dr. Andrew McFarland, you know, he writes that his ideal therapy is that the women learn to discover that he is their superior, as he puts it. He wants them to learn to, become elevated by his smile and to bow at his reproof. And he says he wants to have control over the clothes that they wear, the food that they eat, even the very thoughts that they think. And there's this sort of, process of indoctrination. It's this, what Elizabeth calls a subduing treatment, where the women are supposed to learn to behave, to submit to this masculine authority. And that's the only way they're supposed to be allowed out and allowed home.
How is she eventually allowed out?
Well, as I say, this is the woman they could not silence. The title is very true. And so there are lots of twists and turns to the story. But ultimately, Elizabeth is released, as her doctor put it, because she'd become a source of unendurable annoyance. Because Elizabeth Packard is, she's described as having an irresistible magnetism. And she essentially attracts everyone around her, both patients and staff. And, she teaches the patients, no, don't listen to this guy telling you that you have to submit. Believe in yourself. Be true to yourself. Reject what he's telling you if you don't feel it's the right thing for you. And so she fires the patients up, basically, and there's, revolution and resistance. And as I say, ultimately, she causes so much trouble in the asylum. She's so inspirational and, she's leading everyone in this charge against the abuse that they're suffering and so on, that eventually she is released back into the world, where she becomes a source of unendurable annoyance to politicians and other people as she strives to change the world and succeeds in improving the rights of women and the mentally ill.
She writes a book, The Great Drama, I think it's called.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And this is, again, part of the reason I wanted to write about her, because it is this journey of a woman, a woman becoming a writer, a woman finding her voice. And I've been able to draw on Elizabeth's writings in writing The Woman They Could Not Silence. So if you read the book, you will hear from her husband, because I've quoted from his diary too, but you also hear from Elizabeth Packard herself. She tells us in her own words exactly what it was like to be a sane woman sent away to an insane asylum. And we walk that journey with her. We walk in step with her. And she is able to bring it to life for us. That she draws on the journal that she wrote in the asylum. She wrote The Great Drama in the asylum as well. And she wrote many other books besides. And so I've been able to draw on them to bring her world and herself to life in the book. And I think it's really special, actually, that she can use her own words to tell her own story. And I've been able to, craft them into my narrative, so that I hope Elizabeth, steps from the page into the reader's minds, full of vibrancy and life, telling us exactly how it is.
She regains custody of her children. She ends up being an independent voice. Does she ally herself then with other movements of the day? Does she then somehow become a suffragist who is, a card-carrying member? Or I'm just wondering to what extent she's her own person, with a parallel cause, or if she becomes sort of institutional, aligned with, the committees and going to the conferences, and that's sort of a suffragist.
Yeah, well, I think, as Elizabeth always did, she, forges her own path and fights her own battles, actually. And you're right, this is a story with a happy ending. It's not just inspirational because of the woman that Elizabeth becomes and that journey that she goes on. It's also inspirational because it does have a happy ending. And that was something that was important to me as well when I was choosing my subject. I wanted to find a book and a story and an individual that did actually have that happy upside. And Elizabeth, I think, is a really interesting person in terms of her revolutionary efforts, because she was a very pragmatic and practical woman. I think because the causes for which she was fighting affected her personally, she was determined to affect change that would, that she would see in her own lifetime. So actually, she wasn't officially a fully card-carrying suffragist, because Elizabeth developed a very clever way of making that argument with politicians. You can see in her early work and the work that she writes in The Asylum that she did believe women should have the vote, and she believed in, you know, a female president. But actually, she doesn't, when she gets back out into the world and she is politically campaigning on the ground, she doesn't push that narrative. You know, she instinctively senses that that is too much, too soon for a woman in the 1860s to do. And of course, she's absolutely right, given how long it actually took for women to win the vote. What Elizabeth Packard says is, you know, you need to change the laws to protect women. You need to change the laws so, for example, a husband cannot send his wife away to an asylum by request. You know, a woman needs protections in laws. And she says, if you don't change these laws to protect us, well, then perhaps we should have the vote. And so she sort of almost uses female suffrage as a sort of scare tactic to scare the male politicians into doing what she wants them to do. Which I think, as I say, is actually quite a clever way of campaigning. You know, she appreciates she's not going to see that bigger change, and she actually uses it to manipulate the politicians into doing what she wants them to do.
Did you have any desire of any kind to pursue Theophilus to his own end?
Well, I did. I followed both of them right to the end of their life. And I will say, I think he had the ending that he wanted, which was that he ended up living in his sister's house, a quite sad, unhappy, gloomy man, you know, surrounded by the four court, you know, the four walls of his room. And I write in the book how there's sort of it's an uncanny parallel, really. You know, he shut up Elizabeth for years in an asylum where she was just locked in her cell, and then he almost sort of ends up having the same fate. But actually, I think it's what he wanted, because he wasn't curious, he wasn't vibrant, he wasn't sociable. He just wanted to sit in his room and almost ignore the changes that were happening in the world and just live in books and inside his own head. And that's the fate that he ends up having.
Do you know if this is kind of news to people? Did you bump into other people who said, oh yeah, I know who Elizabeth Packard was?
No, and actually most people have never heard her name before. And what's wonderful is I'm getting emails from readers, you know, now the book is out and it's available, you know, thanking me for bringing her to public recognition, because they can't believe that her story isn't taught in, you know, history classes, for example, because she really did have an extraordinary impact on the world in terms of the laws that she changed. And as I say, her personal story and her personal resilience and perseverance are, you know, so iconic. It's quite shocking in a way that she isn't better known and better remembered. But I think that is also illustrative of what happens to women who stick their heads above the parapet. You know, I said at the beginning, you know, this book was inspired by the Me Too movement and this idea of the fact that women have been silenced for centuries through this allegation of madness. And actually, that is what happens to Elizabeth. So she has this extraordinary life. But as the 20th century begins, her legacy is lost again. And when I looked at the sort of centenary flashback papers in Jacksonville from 1960, you know, Elizabeth's case was a very famous case in its time. And so the papers were, you know, looking back, what was big news in 1860s? Well, it was this. And the 1960s papers recorded her as a nutcase who couldn't keep her mouth shut. Huh. And for a long time, that was Elizabeth Packard's legacy. And it's been brilliant to reveal the truth behind that, you know, slur, really, and say she wasn't a nutcase who couldn't keep her mouth shut. She was an assertive woman who would not be silenced.
And clearly this is a... Well, how do I say this? I mean, this is a tactic that is still used. It's an ad hominem argument. Once the arguments are too strong to counter, even today, people will say, well, that person's lost their mind. You don't need to listen to that.
Completely. And it happens very often to women in the public eye. You know, politicians, I think, are a prime example of where that happens. You know, when Vice President Kamala Harris announced that she was going to be Biden's running mate, she was called a mad woman. Hillary Clinton, when she ran for president, she was called hysteric. So we see this time and again, this idea of women's mental health being used as this thing that is used to control and undermine us and to discredit us. So I think the parallels in Elizabeth Packard's story are actually incredibly haunting. And I think a lot of people reading the book, I hope they do see those parallels and it makes them think about the modern day too.
Kate Moore is author of The Woman They Could Not Silence, One Woman, Her Incredible Fight for Freedom, and The Men Who Tried to Make Her Disappear. Kate Moore, thanks again for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to chat to you.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. A generation after Elizabeth Packard was forcibly committed to a mental hospital, Elizabeth Cochran snuck her way into one on purpose. You may know her by her pen name, Nellie Bly. Bly was one of several female journalists in the late 19th century to make their mark via incognito muckraking. That story is coming right up on Constant Wonder. Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Back in 1887, a reporter with the pen name of Nellie Bly famously got herself committed to an insane asylum to uncover abuse there. This type of covert reporting by female reporters was denigrated as a stunt, but it led to real change. Sometimes successful, sometimes dismissed as sensational, these reporters opened up journalism to other women and made discoveries that their male counterparts never could have. Bly's work, in particular, remains famous not only for selling a lot of papers, but for its impact on the treatment of the mentally ill, of either gender. To learn more, Marcus Smith spoke with Kim Todd, the author of Sensational: The Hidden History of America's Girl Stunt Reporters. This conversation gets rolling here with Todd explaining how she got caught up in the work of Nellie Bly.
I teach and write literary nonfiction, and so I was interested in the history of literary nonfiction and how the genre developed. Some people talk about it as creative nonfiction. And I was reading Nellie Bly's 10 Days in the Madhouse, which is the book that compiles her reporting for The World about her experiences at Blackwell's Island. And I was just struck by how she was doing so many things that we think of as techniques of modern day contemporary nonfiction, creative nonfiction. She had this very personable voice that made you just want to like go along with her for the ride. And she wrote in scenes and she used a lot of dialogue. And it just read like a novel in a way that we don't think of maybe 19th century reporting reading like a novel. And then what was also interesting about Bly was that I knew about her, but I realized, looking into it, that she had spurred this like decade-long opportunity for women reporters to do the kind of reporting that she was doing, you know, going undercover, putting on a disguise, and investigating societal ills, particularly ones that were relevant to women.
So it was the writing of Nellie Bly that caught your attention first, and then you started to see that there was not just Nellie, but several other people who followed her course or had a parallel track.
Yeah, I think a lot of readers of Pulitzer's The World, which Bly wrote for, had the same response that I did. Like, wow, like this is like a really engaging story, really well told. I would like to read more of this. And it was really a sensation in the way that it sold a lot of newspapers. She kind of became famous almost immediately afterwards in terms of, you know, having her name in the headlines as opposed to just a story that any reporter had done. And like she opened the door for all of these other women to have similar careers. And it happened almost immediately. She wrote that story for The World in 1887. And, you know, all throughout 1888, you have newspaper after newspaper hiring women to do this kind of undercover work.
So what was the actual story she went after in the insane asylum? And how did she do it?
Yeah, so Blackwell's insane asylum was really notorious, and there was bad stories coming out of it for years before. But no one had been able to write about it from the inside. So her start at The World was that Colonel Cockrell, the editor there, suggested to her that if she wanted a job at The World, that she should try sneaking into the asylum. So she pretended to be insane and got herself committed to the asylum. Part of that process she details through her series of stories. She went to a boarding house for women, started acting very unstable there. They took her to the police court. They referred her to Bellevue Hospital. And finally, Bellevue Hospital said, yes, she's insane. She should go to the asylum. And she spends 10 days there and comes out and writes this very long, very detailed two-part series over the fact that, like, the inmates are freezing cold, they're being fed rancid and rotten food, and probably worst of all, there's no way to gauge like whether or not they're actually insane. She says that as soon as she got there, like, she stopped acting different from the normal way that she would act, and there was just no reevaluation. And also many of the women there did not strike her as having any mental problems. They struck her as, like, poor, maybe they had committed adultery and their husbands were not happy with them. Maybe they didn't have other family resources. And so they were put there for all kinds of other reasons. And it had a big effect. She got more money appropriated for the asylum. She got more female doctors to be assigned to the asylum. So it was not only a good read, but it really had practical on-the-ground effects.
Was it as easy for her to get out of the asylum as it was for her to get in? I mean, I can imagine that once you've been committed, then she has to do some persuading, or maybe somebody on the outside came and blew her cover for her.
Yeah, she had to have a lot of trust in the paper that she was working for, which she had only recently started working for, remember. But on the 10th day, a lawyer from the paper came and said, oh, you know, I'm a family member. I will, you know, vouch for her. And they got her out that way, to her great relief, I think.
So did she do this on commission? Was she an employee? Or was this kind of prove yourself and then we'll give you a job?
I think it was very much prove yourself and then we'll give you a job. She started out writing for the Pittsburgh Dispatch and was a very ambitious young woman and said, like, I'm going to go to New York. That's where you make your career. That's where the big papers are. And then she spent like months and months in New York not able to get a job. The jobs were very competitive, and most papers wanted to hire men because they were seen as being able to write more kinds of stories. So, yeah, this was really like the dare of, if you're able to do this, maybe we'll consider hiring you.
Now, this genre of reporting, was this a new thing or was it just new to have women doing it at this time?
I mean, so there certainly had been undercover reporters before, and there had even been people, mainly in England, who went undercover to like poor houses and spent the night there. A number of things that Bly did were very innovative. One was that she was a woman kind of gaining access to woman-dominated spaces. So all of a sudden, people like her and people following in her wake were able to write about, you know, the treatment of women in a public hospital or the situation of women working in a factory where all the employees were women. So it was access to a different world, which hadn't really appeared in the mainstream newspapers before. And then also, as I mentioned, part of it was just her style and writing ability. She wrote, her writing was very accessible to a wide variety of readers, and was just very engaging, was just very a well-told story. And, you know, she wrote with a lot of sympathy for the people that she's writing about, where as some of these stories in England where people were going into the poorhouse, you know, they were really writing about the poor with a sense of disgust. And she really makes them seem much more sympathetic.
Yeah.
Of help and care.
Well, I have had the opportunity in past years to look at old newspaper reports from the late 1800s. And I have to say, when I read some of those things, it does not read like journalism today, you know, at least not credible journalism today. There's kind of a detached voice that we hear today. Some people would call it impersonal. Nellie Bly's reporting, I guess, was anything but impersonal.
It was anything but impersonal. She wrote using the I, which was also controversial, right? It was a first-person report, and she created this very engaging, likable character who you wanted to follow along with. It included a lot of sensory detail, and it was from a very close perspective. You know, when she's, like, thrown in this dirty, cold bath at the asylum, you really feel, like, the coldness of it right along with her. So it was a very different style on a lot of different levels. And as I said, I teach literary and creative nonfiction, and one of the things that struck me about her writing was that it's still the things that I'm asking my students to do, right? Put yourself right next to, let the reader sit right next to you as you take them along on this journey.
Well, let's see from you if you can tell us at what point does her credibility suffer, because when I hear the word stunt these days, I think about some kinds of either machinations or manipulations or tricks. And I want to have a fair story. I understand that at some point people began to think, well, you know, she's not giving us the straight story.
Well, I actually think that the use of stunt, I use it in my title, but I put it in quotations, this sense of girl stunt reporters. I think that that's used to describe these women's investigation to kind of discredit them. And I think that if it were men doing similar reports, as a lot of male muckrakers who came right afterwards, it would be called investigative reporting. So I'm sort of highlighting in the book the way that calling it a stunt is really making of it a double standard. I don't know that Bly's work suffered from challenges of credibility. The paper really defended her. Certainly some people were very upset by the asylum reporting and other reporting that she did, which took on powerful interests, whether it was, you know, lobbyists in Albany, New York, or people who were trying to bust unions. And the papers always defended her, and I don't think that she was ever shown to really have printed things that were untrue.
Kim Todd is the author of Sensational, The Hidden History of America's Girl Stunt Reporters. She was speaking there with Marcus Smith. I'm Tenery Taylor. When lizards develop feet that better help them navigate concrete, what do you call that? We're calling it urban evolution. Coming up right after the news.